a Jerry Pippin special report. Consciousness and the UFO.
Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin. We're going to talk to Dr. Bruce McAbee first, then bring in Grant Cameron, and maybe Grant and Bruce both can join in the conversation. But first, before we bring on Grant, who, by the way, is going to be lecturing on this topic in Philadelphia this weekend, and that's one reason we even planned the show. And then Dr. Bruce McAbee became available, and I thought, you know, we never get a chance to talk to him enough. And by the way, Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
And, you know, we urge people to stick around, excuse me, for the end of the show. And when your part's over, we're going to close out with you playing the piano. Do you still have that CD for sale?
Yes, I do. And the last piece on the CD called New Age Rising was composed to be played at the 1997 MUFON Symposium, 40 years, 40th anniversary. And it was, I guess, in some way inspired by UFOs.
Yeah, we're going to play one of those selections here in a little bit. You really enjoy playing music, don't you? And because I've talked to people at your house a couple of times, and they say, well, Bruce is down at the church playing music.
Yeah, that's right. I've played for churches as well as dances and concerts and stuff. Unfortunately, my my right hand has taken a hit, a loss in capability over the last some number of months. So I'm not up to speed like I used to be, but I can still do some. I can still bend a good key here and there.
Now, when we talk to you, we usually talk about photographic evidence and things like that, and we'll probably talk about that tonight as well. But what's happening with Bruce McAbee of late? You got any interesting things to tell us?
Well, Jan and I got married back in February, and we've got a new horse. Whether the Facebook page of me or Jan McAbee, you'll find stuff that's up to date as to what's happening. Aside from that, my son is in a band called The Tenth Hour, which is taking a national tour at the present time. It's a metal band, and they've been hitting some 50 places in 60 days, I think it is, in September and October. And the projectindependent.net, if you look at that, you can see where this band is going to be. On what day and what location, if anybody's interested in going and listening.
Bruce, I'm going to bring in Grant Cameron to say hello to you. You guys know each other, right? I mean, he's talked to you before.
Yes.
Yeah, I've known Bruce fairly well because he helped me out. He was involved in the Rockefeller Initiative stuff, so he was kind enough to provide me the briefing that he had prepared for President Clinton science advisor and helped me out quite a bit in putting that story together. So, yeah, we go back quite a while.
Bruce, a lot of people call on you, and you keep busy just helping people with their stories.
Well, that's true. I get one or two photo cases, sometimes more than that, per week, most of which turn out to be, you might say, accidents of photography as opposed to something that's provably a UFO. One case I recently investigated involved a image of a vertical line of exposed film, or actually it wasn't film, it was a digital camera, but silhouetted against the blackness of the sky. Somebody was trying to take pictures of meteors and simply taking pictures hoping a meteor would fly through it, and he got this vertical line in which colors change, a lot of line colors change from red to green, yellow to orange, and so on. He wondered what in the world it was. He didn't think it was a meteor, so I analyzed it and decided that he had moved the camera a little bit. He was apparently looking at a very bright light, maybe Venus or a star or planet. and the color change was a result of twinkling due to the atmosphere. I got on my website pictures out of a video showing what happens when you take a picture of a bright light in the at night, when it's, especially when it's low on the horizon, you get a lot of color changing, and people don't understand that. But that's the type of thing that I get, daytime photos of accidents, you might say. But occasionally, not too far from where I live, there was a very interesting video of a light taken last April. And it seems to me that something happened to the cell phone the guy was using to videotape it. At any rate, I haven't come to any conclusions as to what that could have been yet. So sometimes you run into things that seem to be unexplainable. You can go to my webpage and you'll see a whole bunch of stuff that's unexplainable.
You mentioned your webpage. Go ahead and give it for everyone. And Grant, give your webpage after he finishes, because both of you guys have some very, very interesting things on there. Well, Bruce, give your webpage right now.
www.brumac.8k.com. That's B-R-U-M-A-C dot number 8, letter K, dot com. Brumac.8k.com. And there's 100 megabytes of worthy information on there.
And Grant Cameron, we're going to talk to you about your lecture coming up in Philadelphia later in the program, but go ahead and give your website now.
My website is the President's UFO website, which is at presidentialufo.com.
And we've got a lot of things we're going to get into here in a little bit. One thing before we even get into any of this, Grant, I want to ask Bruce one thing that I've been meaning to ask him several times. And that's the evolution of technology. You've been doing photographic analysis for a long time, Bruce. And has the technology improved at all, or is it kind of messed up? Give us an overview of how this works.
Well, of course, you have to know how the ancient technology, which we still have with us, that is, taking pictures that that create film, and how that differs from modern technology, which uses so-called charge-coupled devices and similar things to record a picture. Old technology and new technology both use optics, lenses, and a camera, whether the camera is a teeny-weeny thing inside your cell phone or a big camera with a big telephoto lens on it, for example. You have to have a lens system that focuses the scene onto a surface. Typically, the surface is flat. So you have a lens that focuses the scene onto the surface, and this is the first half, you might say, of a photographic system, is the focusing part. In the old technology and the new technology, the focusing part is the same. The recording part, which you look at afterwards and see the picture, that's what has changed. In the old days, it was a film. Of course, you can still get film. And that was a light coming in through the optical system gets focused onto the film surface and actually affects the chemistry of the surface a little bit. And then you run the film through various chemicals known as developers and fixers and stuff, and you end up with a picture. Could be black and white, could be color, depending on the nature of the surface that you're focusing onto, the type of film. More modern cameras use charge coupled devices that are made up of an array, an XY, or a vertical horizontal array of things which we call picture elements, pixels, P-I-X-E-L. Each pixel is a little light detector, a little thing that responds, it puts an output voltage that's proportional to how much light it's collected over a period of time. So you have a shutter in both the old technology and the new technology. A shutter is something which opens the optical system for a period of time and then closes it after a period of time. This could be a few seconds, it could be a very small fraction of a second that the shutter is open. And once these, once the shutter is open, light is either hits film or it hits these pixels of a CCD detector and is recorded, and then the shutter closes. You have, because the shutter is not open for, because the shutter is open for a short period of time, if you have a an object that's moving or if the camera is vibrating, you can get a blurred image. That happens both with old technology and new technology. Now, the new technology with the pixels and so on is very amenable to manipulation by computer techniques. You take a picture and you can brighten it, you can darken it, you can stretch it, you can warp it, you can add things in, take things out, all with the aid of a computer system. People know about various computer programs for modifying pictures, whether the pictures are taken by a camera or scanning a film type picture to put it into a computer.
And, Grant, as we could tell by what Bruce was saying, it's no wonder he's recognized as an expert. I know you've gone to him, and a lot of people have. And we're going to get into some of the things you're doing, Greg Cameron, here in a minute. But one of those things, is it okay if I bring up Chase Brandon to you, Grant? I mean, we talked about it for a long time. But what's the latest on this guy?
Well, he did about 6 or 7 interviews, and then he just disappeared. I think it's probably one of the most significant stories to happen in the last couple of years, because even though I got a question through to some of the interviewers who were interviewing him, he stated that at no time did the CIA ever talk to him about this story that he put out, that he had seen this box with Roswell material that confirmed that Roswell had existed at Langley headquarters. He said the CIA never talked to him about it. He didn't talk to the CIA about the fact he was going to say this. And I just don't think that's plausible. So I think
Dr. McAbee's been involved with the government. He worked for the Navy, the department, right, at one time? Do you know Chase Brandon?
No.
You know anything about him?
No, nothing about him, except I read some message saying his first name was Charles.
Yeah.
And Chase.
Yeah, right. Does this sound plausible to you that the CIA didn't talk to him?
Well, I don't know. The CIA's done some funny stuff, shall we say, over the years. And has taken what I'd call a muddled approach to this problem. I'm sure that most people at the CIA don't know anything about this subject. When I spoke to the CIA as a lecturer in the summer, July of 1987, I gave a lecture at the CIA building in what I was told was the director's conference room. There were about 50 people who attended a lunchtime briefing. This was unclassified. I told them about their own documents. CIA documents had been released in December of 1978. 900 and some pages that the CIA initially had said didn't exist. And then a judge, under a lawsuit that was filed against the CIA, a judge directed the CIA to search their files, find out if they had anything on UFOs, and sure enough, they had 900 pages worth of stuff on UFOs. And that was released in December of 1978.
Either
6
or 87.
1978. Okay. CIA stuff was released in December of 1978. So in 1987, when I spoke, to my great surprise, hardly anybody there knew that there was UFO stuff in the CIA files. I was told afterwards that I created a lot of spies in the agency. People with clearance levels that could see almost anything they wanted were suddenly going around trying to see what there was on UFOs. But so far as I know, nobody ever found anything. Now, if there was a box down there in a sealed room, my first question about this guy, Mr. Brandon, would be, do you just go down into a sealed room with his TS material and start rummaging around saying, oh, yeah, here's this, and oh, yeah, here's that, and does he have any clearance for doing anything like that? Perhaps. I mean, again, just because there are rules and regulations doesn't mean that everybody obeys them to the letter. So maybe he's telling the truth. If there was a box there and he left it there, somebody else must have been able to find it. Either there's a top-secret group in the CIA that's controlling this stuff and doesn't tell anybody else, and maybe by accident Mr. Brandon found this box, and the cover-up group, when they heard that, immediately ran to get that box and put it somewhere else so if anybody did look, they wouldn't find what Mr. Brandon was talking about.
Well, Grant, that's a pretty candid statement by Bruce about the whole thing. What do you make of it?
Guessing on my part.
Yeah. My question is would, because when he describes his position, he said that he was the second most powerful person in the CIA to make public statements on behalf of the CIA outside the director of the CIA, that his office was on the seventh floor. He was with the CIA director right outside the CIA director's office. And to have this guy sort of throw, they play him as a retired guy, but he basically stated that nobody really retires, that we like to help out, and he's under contract. So he's basically still working for the CIA. I'm not really worried about the story. I'm worried about the fact that he would go on coast to coast with whatever 10, 15 million people and sort of throw the CIA under the bus, the UFO bus, without any repercussions. That's the part that sort of bothers me, that it's almost like this was planned for him to do it, because it happened on the 65th anniversary of Roswell, the same as when Corso came out. It was on the 50th anniversary of Roswell, and you get these sort of incidents happening, and I just can't believe that he, in this powerful position that he was in, would go out and do this in public, and nobody would even talk to him about it.
Well, you got to realize that is an argument made by with respect to a lot of leaks of information, and the problem for the CIA would be, well, if we go and beat on this guy, it's going to look like we cared. It's going to look like there really was something he's covering up. So it's best to ignore it entirely. And in this situation, if they could take that box and put it somewhere else, they would cut him off at the knees, so to speak, by not leaving any positive evidence around for somebody else to find.
Yeah, that's true. Although the other thing he points out is the fact that this whole thing he claims is part of this releasing this science fiction book. And he stated that he went two or three times through the review agency. The CIA reviewed this book and told him, you've got to take this out, you've got to add this. So in this little tiny science fiction book he's putting out, he goes to them and gets authorization to do all this stuff. But when he's got to go out the coast to coast, he wouldn't think, when he knows all the rules, he was the head liaison to Hollywood, that he wouldn't know the rules to go there and sort of pre-approve this thing. And I know for a fact that before he even went on coast to coast, he was talking to some people in England, and he basically gave them the hint he was going to do this. So it's almost like it was planned. That's the part I don't understand about.
Dr. Maccabee earlier said they like to muddle the waters, so maybe that's what's happening here.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, if it did happen where he wasn't, they would stand back because they don't want to give it any attention. But indirectly, like for example, when it first came out, as you know, Billy Cox from Tampa Tribune contacted the archivist, the actual guy, because he comes out, he makes the statement on coast to coast. Then we write a letter to the CIA. There's four of us write the letter to the CIA. The CIA comes back to us and said, We will look into this and notify you as soon as possible. And so what would they do? They would play the tape from coast to coast. They would ask Chase Brandon, what did you say? Where's the box? And so Billy Cox goes and talks to the archivist, who would have been the guy that would have been looking for the box. And he says, I have nothing to say. I stand by the CIA statement. And their statement was not that he was lying, not that he was telling the truth, but just that there's nothing to substantiate what he said, which is, it's just a very bizarre, it's almost like this limited hangout thing where they want it out there, and they let it out, they pull it back, and then they go back to the company policy, which Chase Brannon says is, oh, the CIA has an interest in UFOs, they couldn't care less, and that's why they really wouldn't be talking to me, which doesn't make sense.
Well, we're going to get back to this subject, but I got a lot of people already in the chat room, and a couple of emails that asked something for Dr. Bruce McAbee earlier when we were talking about the photographic evidence of UFOs. And Wayne, who's known as a UFO cowboy in the chat room there, had this question for McAbee. He says, if a person has an outstanding video or photo, what is the best way to get it to you, Dr. McAbee, with emails and Facebook and such being monitored so heavily these days? In other words, they're questioning whether or not you get your emails or on Facebook. I know you're on Facebook quite often. I have people telling me they've been censored by Facebook. I haven't. Maybe you guys have. I don't know. So, Dr. McAbee, what's the best way to get some video to you?
Well, if it can be packed into a standard video format of some sort, and it's not too long, you send it by email, brumac@compuserve.com. My email address, and I prefer to work through that if it's at all possible. Otherwise, I suppose you can put it on a CD, put it on a DVD, and send it to me. But contact me at brumac@compuserve.com first, and I can give you an address to send a DVD to.
You know, I get a lot of leads from the public on good stories for broadcast. How about you, Grant? Do you get some interesting emails, something just over the transom in cyberspace to you that
hands
out?
That's one of the things that, like, Bruce and I were sort of involved in the 80s following Bill Moore and all the leaks there, and I always had stated that I must not be doing the right thing because nobody's ever come and tried to leak me a classified document or anything of that nature. And I was wondering, well, you know, I must be on the wrong track because, you know, I was always waiting for the Falcon or some bizarre person to come and say, okay, you know, I've got some stuff and here it is. It's never happened to me, ever.
Dr. McAbee, how did that Avery thing start? Did Bill Moore just manufacture that out of thin air, or how did they get started?
Well, I don't know. Grant may be able to do a better history on this than I can, but my recollection is that the things began to pop when the Roswell Incident book was published in 1980, I think that was, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay, so Bill told me, and I had many conversations with him over the years, he told me that a few months or something like that after the book was published, he got a contact. And from a guy who wouldn't say initially who it was, but I guess it turned out to be Rick Doty. Anyway, a guy in intelligence, and who told him that he was on the right track. That is, the supposed crash at Roswell was on the right track, and that there might be more information coming. And then he managed to get, he did receive some leaked documents. Perhaps the most famous of them, of the early documents, is the so-called Aquarius document, referring to Project Aquarius. It had to do with UFOs, but he got this document and some other stuff over the next several years. It wasn't until 1987, though, that the so-called Eisenhower briefing document came out public. Now, he was telling me that he had sources, okay, and two of the major sources, he wouldn't say who they were, but they were government people and intelligence, and he named them as the Condor and the Falcon. This was sort of...
How did you get your name? Weren't you called the Seagull?
Yeah.
Who gave that to you, Bill Moore?
Before too long, virtually everybody was part of the aviary. only the Condor and the Falcon, and I guess the Condor Who's this guy who's most recently come out, been named as the...
Yeah, Grant did a lot on that. We're right. talking about the guy nobody ever heard about, Grant. Remember his name?
Rositsky.
Right.
Yeah, the CIA guy.
Yeah, and Grant, jump in here in this conversation. This is right down your cup of tea.
Well, I think what happened, my impression of what happened was Bill put the book out, and he was contacted almost immediately, like days after he went on the book tour. And what I recall in my research was that by 1981, he said there was so much material coming in that he joined up with Jamie Chandray. And Jamie Chandray and he worked on all sorts of stuff. And I think what they did, the idea for the Avery was that when he and Jamie were talking on the phone, in order to protect who they were talking to, they would give all these people bird names. And I guess Bruce had a bird name because he was talking to you about, you know, whatever events or whatever. And he'd given a bunch of people bird names, and a lot of people didn't even know they were, you know, bird. It was an idea that Bill came up with. For example, I talked to, when Falcon was released, I contacted Scott Jones. And there was a lot of articles back in the 1990s where people were saying Scott Jones was the Falcon. So when this Rositsky guy was identified by Bill Moore's friend Greg Bishop, I went to Scott Jones and I said, well, here's the Falcon. You're no longer the Falcon. And he said that he had actually had three bird names, and he never knew which bird name was his, because that was just something between Jamie and Bill. And so nobody really knows how many birds there were or who the birds were or what their names were. Only Bill and Jamie Chandray know that secret.
How does that check out with you, Bruce?
There were lots of birds of a feather flocking, but nobody is doing this together.
It's been, exactly.
So you guys didn't have a bird convention someplace?
Yeah, well, there never was a bird convention. The only two birds that really counted were falcon and condor. And things got very messed up back in 87 at the UFOs, or let's see, what was the name of that show?
UFO Cover-Up Live.
UFO Cover-Up Live. It was done as a live show in October of 1987, I think it was. And at that show, they had impenetrable screen-type interviews with supposed Condor and Falcon. Actually, Condor was Robert Collins, and Falcon was Richard Doty. These were stand-ins for the real people. I understood that, but for many years, other people who were doing investigations did not understand fully that Doty and Collins were stand-ins for the real people.
Yeah.
But there was another guy who came along. It was Falcon and Condor were the only members of the aviary until about 1986. But there was another guy who came along who was given a code name Hawk. That was Ernie Kellerstrauss, a retired Air Force colonel who had been at a science branch in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And here was a guy whose testimony would blow the lid off if he could prove it was true. I interviewed him at an extent in the end of 1985 and early 1986. And I'll have on my webpage the story that Hawk told. But as far as this aviary is concerned, as I said, it sort of grew like mushrooms in the rain. As time went on, everybody was being called, anybody who worked for the government was considered to be covert shill for the government and given a bird name. I did something that was, I actually dug up some information that was valuable. I discovered that there were two Project Aquariuses. One of them was classified secret, the other one was classified top secret. I never did find out what the top secret one was about, because I didn't have a TS clearance at the time. But anyway, they gave me the name Seagull, and it just sort of grew from there. Virtually anybody who was doing any UFO research related to government cover-up was given a bird name after a while. And I guess there could be a dozen or a dozen and a half birds in the aviary. There was never a group.
It wasn't formal, in other words.
It was never a formal group, and we never met. I mean, a lot of the bird people I knew because of UFO investigations, and some of them I didn't know at all. I don't know how they got names. It's been a long time since I've paid much attention to that stuff. But there, you can't look up on the internet, I guess, and find out.
Yeah, it's kind of ancient history for a lot of people, and a lot of people have never heard about it. But it's interesting in many ways, the guessing game.
Can I maybe bring up something with Bruce, and maybe he can clarify this, because this has been going around ufology for a number of years. After Bill made this speech, he made this famous speech in Las Vegas in 1989, where he admitted to handing this one document to Paul Benowitz, which was a document he knew to be phony. The story's always going around when you bring up Bill Moore's name, that Bill Moore is this bad guy. He was working for the government in counterintelligence, and he was there to throw everybody off. And I'd like to get Bruce's experience. My experience with Bill Moore, I dealt with him a fair bit, and he helped us on the Dr. Eric Walker case when nobody else would. My impression of Bill Moore, and I'd like to hear your impression, was that Bill Moore was just a guy who believed that if he got on the other side, on the inside with the government, that he was a smart enough guy that he could figure out what was going on, and that he actually was trying to get to the bottom of it. He wasn't really a bad guy. He was a guy who was really trying to get to the truth. And I wanted to hear maybe Bruce's impression, because he dealt with Moore an awful lot more than I did.
Yeah, well, that was certainly my impression, too. I was very surprised. I was not at the MUFON Symposium in 1989, so I heard about his lecture and the fact that he left immediately afterwards.
Yeah.
No questions, goodbye. And I was surprised at that. I knew that he had had interactions with Benowitz, and of course I had myself. I talked to Benowitz, and it was clear that he was balancing on the third rail. I wrote about the events in 1980 in a paper called Welcome to the Cosmic Watergate. And it's about a landing at Kirtland Air Force Base, but also brings in some stuff related to Benowitz. A paper on my website. But I always thought that Bill was basically on the low, trying to use whatever means he could to find out, to penetrate the inside. Yeah. And he had hoped that with Falcon and Condor's help, he would be able to come up with stuff. One of the things was that this Eisenhower briefing document, which I guess is sort of uniformly panned, but that may or may not be justifiable. In any case, that document, the Eisenhower briefing document, would blow the lid off if you could prove it was true. If it was a fake, then it was an excellently done fake. Now, I don't think that Bill Moore did it himself, which is what the skeptics claim.
Yeah.
Moore and Chandra made this whole thing up by themselves. I don't believe that.
Yeah, he was a smart guy. That was my impression. He was a very smart guy, and his sort of his ego got in the way that he figured he could sort of play both sides, and sort of ended up getting burned by the other side. But I was very impressed with the work he did. And anybody who people these days don't really know, but if you read the research material that he put out, whether it was on the Aztec crash or Area 51 or anything, he put out a lot of very detailed material that showed that he was spending an awful lot of time, and he didn't jump to conclusions, and he was a very sharp researcher.
Yes. I don't really know what he's doing nowadays. He hasn't been in the field at all since about 1989 or 89.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering about that, too. I guess he's still alive.
Yeah, apparently he went home. His father was sick. He's on the East Coast now, from what I heard. And I know that there's a couple researchers who are in contact with him. And when I published the article on the Falcon, I'm sure it was sent to him. But when he left, he left. He just sort of dropped it. He did a couple of interviews with Greg Bishop in about 2003, which were very interesting interviews. But other than that, he sold all his material on eBay and left, and basically has not gotten back in.
Okay, well, before we get out of the subject, Doty got the rap of being the Falcon or the Condor, one or the other, simply because he was did it for this television show. Who was the Falcon, Bruce? Do you have any idea? Or was it a composite of several people?
I think it was one person, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy Rositsky, we found out. I forget how. Grant, how did we find out that he was a?
Well, he had told. Greg Bishop was very close friends with him, and Greg Bishop had been working on the problem, and eventually Moore told him who it was, and then you probably know Brian Paul. Brian Parks.
Parks, yeah.
Yeah, who worked with Bill on the Focus magazine and stuff. And he phoned up Bill. He contacted him, and Bill confirmed to him, yes, that was who it was. And to me, it still didn't make sense because I'm pretty sure, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm still pretty sure that Bill had indicated that the Falcon was in the Defense Intelligence Agency. And I was given a name of an Admiral Edward Burkhalter in DIA, who is people, and I respected the people who told me that he was the Falcon. So, but Bill did confirm to two people that was the Falcon, this Harry Rositsky, who was this former Soviet spy, super spy, who had been brought out of retirement to run this operation. So,
yeah, you know, as long as we're talking about the alphabet agencies, I've got to ask both of you about Ron Pandolfi. His name keeps coming up all the time. I think I got an email from him one time, somebody claiming to be him. Do either one of you know Ronald Pandolfi?
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen him for a number of years. I exchanged very brief emails once every 4 or 5 years, I guess. But back in the 80s, we were sort of very active together on a legitimate basis, in the sense that Pandolfi was responsible for finding out why we were behind the Russians in a phenomenon known as laser-generated underwater sound. And I was doing experiments on that stuff at the Naval Surface Warfare Center where I worked. But you have to go back a little bit earlier.
So he does exist.
Oh, yeah.
I guess he's still with the CIA, or maybe he's with the White House. I hear all kinds of stories. I don't know. Grant, do you know where he is these days? I mean, who he's working for?
My story, the way I've got it, is he was CIA, then he went to the big intelligence agency, the National... Yeah. Intelligence?
Office of the Director of National Intelligence, ODNI.
He was there for about a year, and then went back to the CIA. I've only gotten one email from him, and he's kind of a mystery to me, and, I mean, I'd maybe get Bruce to try to give his impression of what we should think of this guy. He gave me one email. This goes back 10 years, and it was basically dealing with the story about, if you know the story that Danny Sheehan told. Danny Sheehan heard the story through Marcia Smith in Washington. And the story was that when Jimmy Carter was elected, in his presidential briefing, he was briefed by the former CIA director under Ford, who was Bush Sr. And because Jimmy Carter had the sighting, he was very interested, and he asked Bush for the CIA files. And Bush had said, I can't give them to you. You got to go to the House Science and Technology Committee. And curiosity on the part of the president is not sufficient need to know. So I put this on my website, and the only email I got from Ron Pandolfi was to say, basically saying to me, if the CIA director refused the president could immediately replace him, use some common sense and check your sources. That was the only email I got, but he's kind of a mysterious guy. I really don't know what to make out of him. Most of the people that I've dealt with that know him think he's on our side, and so I really don't know. I mean, he's sort of there, and he's sort of dropping stuff and stories, and a very elusive guy. But you know, the people that seem to know him say that he's a good guy. He's not, you know, trying to throw us off, or he's interested. I don't know. Bruce would probably know him better than I do.
Well, yeah, he's been on Pandolfi ever since '83, I think it is. I just haven't had much communication with him in the last 8 or 10 years. But as an aside comment, apropos to this mention of Carter's being briefed, I seem to recall Bill Moore had what were claimed Carter briefing documents at some time back in the 80s. So he had, Bill Moore said that he had been given a runaround where somebody calls up on the telephone and says, go to a certain place, and you get your next instructions, and he goes to the next place. He gets another phone call, and he gets told to go to another place. And he ends up, after going to several places, he ended up in a motel, and a guy walks in to the room that he's in. The guy walks in and gives him some papers you can have to do with it, and you want with these papers for the next 20 minutes or half an hour or whatever, and then I'm going to come back and take them. So Bill photographed all these papers. He held them down flat with a quarter stuck in the lower right, left-hand corner of the paper. And then the guy comes back and takes the papers. And Bill ultimately ended up, these papers got out, the copies of them got out, and Bill knew that they were stuff that he had because there was the quarter as part of the image of the copy of the document. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's not relevant per se to...
Well, it's an interesting story. I had not heard that before.
But Bruce, he did get you to do the that was my involvement with you, is he did get you to do this briefing for Gibbons. Is that not right?
Let me start at the beginning. This story probably hasn't been told in full, and I don't have time to do it. We don't have time to do it, but...
Well, we might make time. That's what I guess.
Back in 1978, the CIA released a bunch of CIA documents on UFOs that, with great reluctance and as a result of being forced to do it by a lawyer, by a judge. And people for years have been saying the CIA was controlling the whole thing. And this is sort of like scuttlebutt in the UFO community back 40, 50 years ago. CIA is controlling the whole thing. So when they copped up a bunch of documents, they said, see that? Bad boys. You've been running. What have you not told us? Where's the top secret documents? Well, there weren't any formerly top secret documents. We assume that there were. Well, in December 1978, sightings happened in New Zealand, which made international news at the time about some people flying on an airplane, taking color movie, and getting radar detections and so on. A very complicated case. And it just so happened that I ended up being the person to investigate that. I went to New Zealand and Australia and interviewed the witnesses and so on. I came back to the United States. And I asked the head of NICAP, National Investigating Committee on Aerial Phenomena, as it existed way back then, if he knew anybody I could talk to get consult on the radar aspect of these sightings. And he told me about a guy at MITRE Corporation by the name of Gordon McDonald. Gordon invited me over to MITRE. I talked for 3 hours there, and they found it very interesting. So why don't you go and talk to some people at the CIA? Immediately, the dread factor hits me in the face. CIA, the guys have been controlling the whole thing, I figure, so how dare I go to the CIA and talk to them about radar related to a UFO sighting? But finally, I decided, well, what the heck, I might learn something one way or another. And so I went there in the April of 1979, I went there, I met this guy, Kit Green, and several other people, and I told them about the New Zealand sightings. And I went back one more time, and Kit told me about what you might say a minor interest of the CIA in UFO stuff and collecting documents and so on. Well, after that, I had no connection with the CIA at all for the next 4 years. In 1983, I think it was, I got a call out of the blue from this guy, Ron Pandolfi. He wanted to talk about what's called laser-generated underwater sound. The reason being, laser-generated underwater sound, it was thought, could be used in a system to detect Soviet submarines, and in particular, the nuclear subs. Now, anything that's got to do with ASW, anti-submarine warfare, is classified up near the top. And so I was immediately in a sort of a classified situation talking about what we knew about laser-generated sound. It just so happened that the Soviets had done a lot of experiments on it. The CIA had found this out and wondered, well, what have we done? We have to be able to evaluate the capabilities of the Soviets. In order to evaluate their capabilities, we have to have our own. It turned out that I was one of the few guys in the United States doing laser-generated sound experiments. So the CIA came to me, and in the form of Ron Pandolfi. So the first phone call I get from him has to do with laser-generated sound. Then he calls again another week or so later to talk about laser-generated sound, and at the end of the conversation, he says, oh, by the way, I understand you were here before. Now, I had not said anything about the UFO connection, that I had been there in 1979. He brought it up. Turns out that he had been asking around about the CIA, about who I was, or if anybody knew who I was, and he talked to none other than Christopher Kit Green. And Kit Green was one of the people that I talked with in 1979. So anyway, Pandolfi found out about my surreptitious interest, you might say. Turned out that he was surreptitiously interested himself, I guess. At first, on a skeptical point of view, I'm not really sure. I never really got a clear reading on whether he was, quote, a, quote, believer, unquote, or a non-believer, unquote. But over the years, we had numerous discussions, and he was the one who set up the noontime lecture that I did in the July of 1987 in the director's conference room. Now, perhaps the most important thing that Pandolfi did for the UFO community, you might say, is that he gave me all the stuff that John Callahan has been talking about for years, had related to the Japan Airlines UFO sighting in November of 1986. There's some confusion as to exactly how that came about, but no sooner did that sighting make it into the news than Pandolfi started getting me interested in it, and we went and talked to Callahan. There's confusion on the part of Callahan himself as to how many meetings he attended. He doesn't remember one attended by me. Callahan has talked about a meeting at which there was the Presidential Science Committee and the CIA and DIA and other representatives, and how they took a box of materials that he had collected, and how they were supposedly taking all the materials and then telling Callahan and the other people that attended that this meeting never occurred, and so on. I was not at a meeting like that, but I was at a meeting with Pandolfi and Callahan. And Pandolfi gave me the collected information that Callahan had. And I used that to write over the next 4 months. Now, the sighting occurred in November 16th, 1986. It became public knowledge in early January of 1987. The skeptics came out with their explanation that it was Mars and Jupiter in February of 1987. In March of 1987, the FAA had completed its investigation and claimed that there was no support for the, no radar support for the sighting. In other words, the radar evidence they were rejecting. They didn't say anything at all about the visual sightings by the pilot and crew. I wrote a long article that ultimately ended up filling up the whole issue of the International UFO Reporter of the Center for UFO Studies in June, I think it was June or July of 1987. That report is on my website, the most complete report ever written on that. At the time I published it, well, it was of some interest, but it wasn't until, that was published in 87, it wasn't until Callahan started talking after he retired in the mid-1990s that this case came back to, you might say, haunt the CIA and haunt the FAA and the government itself. It's featured in Leslie Kane's newest book, UFOs, I forget the exact title of it. Anyway, the point is that I was able to write that article, do a complete in-depth analysis of that sighting, because I had all the information necessary to do it, And I got that because Pandolfi got it for me.
So that's a pretty good evidence that Pandolfi may be a good guy, Grant. I found on Greg Bishop's website, April 9th, 2012, he dated it at 9:46 a.m. He says, "I don't think I'll ever hear from Bill again," talking about Bill Moore. "He has stopped answering my emails and my calls. I don't know what that means. Probably that he wants nothing whatsoever to do with the paranormal field anymore. It makes me sad, but that appears to be what his choice is. I also think that perhaps people are way too quick to point fingers at Bill Moore because he admitted to working with the government on some level, while others who most certainly did work on some level to some extent or another have never confessed at all, have never said anything. Seeing what happened to Moore, they probably never will. The UFO field does perfectly well at creating its own disinformation. It's always been and always will be the case." I have to agree with Greg Bishop on that last statement. What do you guys think?
Yeah, well,
I suppose in some sense you could say we are our own worst enemies, but it depends on who you're talking about. I've personally tried to stay away from all sorts of theorizing and calling other people names and so on and just concentrate on individual sightings and trying to come up with sightings that absolutely cannot be explained. And this is what I've got on my website. That's keeping my feet to my nose in the dirt, you might say. Nose to the grindstone or whatever, because as far as I'm concerned, it's the sightings that have to put this over, not the pontifications of people who think they know something.
Yeah, Grant, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, people that aren't really researching sightings or doing hardcore research, it's sort of like they're analyzing other researchers' research. And I guess Bill's problem was that he was, and people don't realize this, in the 1980s, Bill was, if not the best, I mean, one of the most prominent researchers there was. He had written this book that had sold a million copies. He had this sort of reputation, and he goes from there to giving a speech at MUFON in 89, where the rumors were that people were throwing stuff at him on the stage. And so he went from the top right to the bottom, and I think that's basically why he pulled out, because he could never give a speech again. I mean, he was sort of like totally ostracized, which sort of gives an indication that in the UFO community, your reputation in a lot of times is all you really have. That once you lose your reputation, it's basically over for you. And Bill had gone so far down in one speech that he basically just sort of turned his back on it. And a lot of stuff, Bill knew a lot of stuff. That, for example, he interviewed General Doolittle. That interview was never made public. He interviewed Maria Wang, Dr. Eric Wang's wife, and Dr. Eric Wang was supposedly working for Kissinger. He did a lot of stuff that I know he did. He did these interviews, and this stuff now will never be released. It'll go to the grave. And Bill had a lot of this material. I know Bob Wood purchased a pile of his files, but not the big files. He got some of the files, but that's one of the sort of the drawbacks is that a lot of the real good stuff that Bill Moore did, he never did release, and nobody will ever see some of the real good work that he did.
I have about 10 or 15 emails and all kinds of Twitters and Facebook messages, but let me ask this. This one that just came up. Either of your guests, this person asked, have trouble with the CIA now, or is it all in the past? In other words, do you have any connections or problems or anything with the CIA. And I don't know, Grant, have you ever done anything with the CIA? I'm not asking you to destroy your reputation now.
No, that's what I said. I've never really had any interaction with anybody claiming to be an intelligence agent or having stuff. The only one contact I had was from Ronald Pandolfi, and I didn't even realize it for years that I had this email from him, and that was him just sort of pointing out this sort of error in this Carter story. But I've never really had any contact whatsoever, but that may be because I'm a Canadian. It's sort of like, you know, if Ronald Pandolfi or anybody ever gave me anything, I'd have to turn them in, you know, because, you know, you shouldn't be talking to a foreigner if it's classified material. So nobody's ever talked to me about that kind of stuff. No intelligent agents.
Well, Bill Moore's a pretty mysterious guy, both of you. I mean, on his bios, I can't really pin down when he was born. I guess around 1943.
Could be. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, so, Bruce, we're about out of time here for this hour, but this problem with Bill Moore is something that I think that maybe you can comment or not comment, but the government's an expert at the stirring the pot, you know what I mean, getting people at each other's throats over emotional issues that are really not important even. I see this over and over and over.
I would suggest that it could be that Bill got enough evidence to prove to himself what was going on, and that he sort of wanted to get a lot of stuff off his chest in 1989 and made the conscious decision to say, okay, I, Bill Moore, have seen enough evidence to convince me that it's not going any farther than this. I'm going to confess that I worked with the government in order to try to find secrets out. And I know that's going to destroy my reputation because nobody likes people who work with the government for some reason or other.
Well, I don't know how else you get the information if you're investigating the government if you don't work with them a little bit.
Yeah, right. So anyway, I'm just saying that imagining that Bill made a conscious decision he was going to leave the field. And just
One final question here before we let Bruce go. We got Grant on to talk about consciousness and UFOs. And Bruce, you're kind of a nuts and bolts guy, but what do you think about all of these theories about UFOs and spirituality and all of that? What do you make of all that? Are you open-minded to that, or?
Well, I've always been a hard-wired person myself.
Well, same here, but and I always thought Grant was, but he's been converted, brother. Well, we'll let him talk for himself on the other side of the break about this.
Yeah, I could go on to more about Pandolfi and what he did with respect to the presidential briefing that he asked me to write for John Gibbons, the Knox advisor of Bill Clinton in 1993. That's an interesting story, and then Grant could pick up on what happened after that. Because things went on for several years after that April briefing that I wrote.
Well, you tell us a little bit about it.
Well, Clinton was elected in 92, right? And in 93 he takes office and he has this guy, John Gibbons, who is the science advisor. Gibbons is a good buddy of Scott Jones. And Scott Jones is a good buddy of Rockefeller. Morris Rockefeller. Rockefeller had been Jones's organization. I forget what that was called right now. But anyway, it was their idea to try to interest John Gibbons sufficiently in the subject of UFOs that he would make a recommendation to President Clinton that they somehow managed to fund UFO research. And in April of 1993, I got a phone call in the afternoon from Pandolfi. I was at home and taking a day off of something or other, I can't remember now. In the afternoon, I got a call from Pandolfi and he says he wanted me to, he wanted me to write a briefing for the president's science advisor on UFOs. And of course, I'm flabbergasted. I could never would have imagined something like that happening. But here I was being handed a big football, you might say, and I had the choice of dropping it or running with it. So I said, okay, well, I'll do what I can. And I assumed, based on much previous experience with the government, that I was being asked to do something that would be required in a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, a month, you know, sometime off in the distance they wanted to have this briefing available. So I say, okay, so when does it have to be done? He says, tomorrow at 8 o'clock in the morning.
So you had a sleepless night.
I was flabbergasted at that, but immediately I hung up, kind of saying, how am I going to do this? I wasn't even at work, so I was going to have to write something and fax it to the CIA representative in John Gibbons' office. Well, now, Pandolfi wanted to have no say at all what I wrote. You wanted no connection. Of course, I'm wondering, you know, why is the CIA contacting me to write a response from the CIA? He was a member of the CIA. And anyway, I assumed that was because he figured I knew more about the subject than he did. I often felt that about the CIA people that I met, that I knew more about the UFO stuff than they did. Anyway, I got to writing as much as I could, and I picked a typical government format of a one to one and a half page overview writing with references to a whole bunch of, you might say, a bunch of different appendices, or they're called tabs, tab A, tab B, tab C, and so on like that. These are like little appendix, standalone appendixes attached to a master cover sheet, the executive cover sheet, you might say. So I figured out sort of how to do it, and I completed my page and a half overview, which didn't have any of the details because the details are left to the tabs. And I faxed that thing off at 8 o'clock in the morning. Then I finished writing, over the next few hours, I finished writing all the tabs and faxed them off the next day. But the next day I contacted the CIA representative at Gibbons' office to find out if Gibbons had actually had a chance to read what I wrote. I should have said the reason they wanted this briefing was Lawrence Rockefeller and Scott Jones had made an appointment with Gibbons to come and visit and talk about UFOs. And so Gibbons had called up the CIA and said, quick, I need a briefing on UFOs. And his request for a briefing went to Pandolfi, because Pandolfi was in charge of the weird desk, you might say. And Pandolfi then called me because he didn't want to write a briefing for Gibbons, I guess. So anyway, that's how that happened to come about. And so I called up to find out if Gibbons had actually read what I wrote before he had seen Lawrence Rockefeller and Scott Jones. I remember I was told that I had to have it there by 8 o'clock, and I did. But then I was told that the meeting had been moved up to 7:30. So by the time my briefing got there, the meeting was all over. I don't know whether Gibbons, I was told that Gibbons actually read something later on. I don't know. It didn't amount to a hill of beans, but as Brent Grant can tell you, there was continual pressure by Jones and Rockefeller on the Clintons, and that did result in some apparent interest by them in the subject, although they, so far as I know, they've never done anything in response to their interest. But even up through the present day, there's some thought that the Clintons might do something.
Okay, Bruce McAbee, thanks for being very candid tonight and being with us. And Grant, camera, hold on. We're going to talk about it. Bruce, we appreciate you being on, and we're going to close out with you playing one of my favorite songs on the piano. And, folks, he's quite a pianist. And I picked this selection because I'm one of the sponsors of the Border Zone Conference down in Presidio, Texas, coming up October 18th, 19th, and 20th, and we have a a big two-hour special with all the researchers on Thursday night, and this time slot on October 18th. And so remember that. Here's Bruce McAbee, and he's south of the border, down Mexico way. Great song, great standard. Thanks, Bruce.
You're welcome.
Unraveled and shaken the UFO and alien research establishment to its core. Already called an incredible book and an incredible story by George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM, UFO Highway offers the most explosive look at the most infamous underground base in the world, Dulce. Critically acclaimed author and researcher Anthony F. Sanchez breaks down the secret underground base and gives readers the innermost glimpse of the secretive military-industrial complex and the forbidden alien agenda. Learn how Sanchez explains the origins of humanity with startling proof, detailing how off-world intervention has been the cause for humanity's rapid and exponential growth in technology. As time draws down, are you prepared for the truth? Order this incredible, eye-opening book today at www.ufohighway.com. That's www.ufohighway.com.
Music that fits consciousnesses and UFOs and the issue, and we're going to talk to Grant Cameron and change the subject a little bit here. Grant, tell me a little bit about this lecture that you're going to be doing in Philadelphia, and what's the event and everything?
It's the MUFON. They have two MUFON meetings there. They have one in Philadelphia this weekend, and then two weeks from now they have it in Pittsburgh. They have fairly good turnout. It's a MUFON group.
And, yeah, John Ventry's involved in that.
Yeah, and I've been to it before. I stopped by. I was at looking at Scott Jones' material at University of Rhode Island, and I came back through there for the conferences not last year, before. So I saw how they work, and they got a fairly good audience, and he does a good job there. So this is a lecture I gave in England 2 weeks ago. I gave two lectures. I gave one on consciousness, and I gave one on a theory that I firmly believe that there's a gradual disclosure, that they're dropping pieces of the UFO story into the public without giving away who's behind it or the classified material and that sort of stuff. And the way I got to this consciousness thing was, it happened last year. I was at the UFO Congress in Phoenix, and almost every one of the lectures had sort of a subtopic of consciousness. So, for example, Stephen Greer was talking, and he always talked about, going out and, trying to flag the UFOs down, the CE5 stuff. And the lecture that really caught me was the very last one. It was a lecture by Colin Andrews, where he talks about consciousness circles. And, Colin Andrews was the expert on crop circles in England, and he had the big catalog of all the crop circles and stuff like that. Was the noted authority. Rockefeller had given him a bunch of money to determine, is this for real or is it hoaxed? And he put out a report that said 80% of crop circles are hoax, only 20% are real, and that was the end of his UFO career. It was like Bill Moore. Nobody wanted to talk to the guy. He's working for the government and all this sort of stuff. So when he appears at Congress last year, he gives this lecture called Consciousness Circles, and his theory now is that 80% or 20% are real, 80% are hoax, but that the 80% that are hoax are also controlled by the aliens, that the aliens are telling the people who are hoaxing the circles what to do. It's coming through their mind. And he brought some pretty interesting evidence that seemed to back up that this could be happening. And the minute he gave this lecture, all the stuff from I've been in this for 37 years, sort of just all these things just popped into my head, and a lot of stuff made sense. And it goes even back to before I got into UFOs, I was into near-death studies. And when I was at university, I did a paper where I went to the hospitals and I talked to chaplains with dying people and asked all these questions. Could people predict their death? Was there any miracles? Did anybody get up when they're about to die and walk away? Did anybody have out-of-body experiences? This is back in the 70s when it first started. And I went into all this bizarre stuff. Now, all this stuff, once I heard this lecture, all these things came into my head. Things that very high-ranking people, for example, Wilbur Smith, who was the head of the Canadian government UFO program, Ben Rich, Wesley Clark, the four-star general who was running for president, and Dr. Eric Walker, all these people that I had researched, things that they had said that never made sense suddenly made sense. So what I did is I put the lecture together, and I guess in terms of what Bruce was talking about, I put it in perspective for you. Today there's an article came out on Huffington Post. It's an article on a friend, a Major Friend, who was the head of Blue Book at one time. And Major Friend, the big article is, UFO should be investigated. He doesn't believe that they're extraterrestrial. He believes, you know, like, how could you get so much food on a spaceship for the distance they have to travel? And a lot of people, Leslie Kane, John Alexander, now a friend, everybody's calling for a new UFO investigation. And what I'm saying is that, for example, you take a look at Bruce McAbee. He's analyzing photographs. We've analyzed photographs since 1950. And basically the most you're going to get from an analyzed photograph is it's unidentified. That's as much as you're going to get. Because John Lear sort of described it. Ufology today is basically how big was it at arm's length and compared to your thumb? What color was it? What direction is it moved in? And what I'm saying is that if you do another UFO study, you're going to come to exactly the same conclusion, whether the government does the study, whether the media does the study, or whether science does the study. If you just look at UFO sightings, things flying around in the sky, photographs, you are going to get nowhere. We are absolutely at a dead end in ufology. We can do nothing. And the best analysis of this, the guy that exemplified this the best, or gave the best example of this, was Jim Dalatoso. And Jim Dalatoso probably did more photo analysis than anybody, had all this equipment. He did the Phoenix Lights photographs, and he did all his analysis. He's basically that's not his main priority. He just deals with contactees. And the example he used is exactly right. What we are doing is equivalent to standing at the top of a tall skyscraper, looking down at all these little things moving along the road. And we can say, well, there's big ones, there's little ones, there's red ones, they're moving in this direction, they're moving in that direction, but you will never know what those things are, you will never know where they're from, what they're doing here, whether they are a natural phenomena or whether they're extraterrestrial, until you go down the elevator, as Travis Walton did, stand in front of one of those things, wave at it, and get zapped and get taken aboard one of those things. The way we have it right now, the most we'll ever get is 12,000 cases. Like, for example, if we do another Blue Book study, we do 12,000 cases, we are going to come up with the same thing. There's going to be 700 unknowns. And when you ask science, media, or the government, if they do the study and say, well, what are the unknowns? They're going to say, well, we don't know. They're just unknowns. They're going to say, oh, they're extraterrestrial. And they'll say, no, we don't know they're extraterrestrial. We just don't know what they are. And that's like a dead end. All we're getting is unknown. And it's not until you get inside the craft or until you talk to whoever is writing in those crafts that you are going to advance the subject. Now, we've made some advances in the last couple of years because it's sort of become known that people have been abducted, and that's sort of being generally accepted in the UFO community that the abduction phenomenon is real. So you have some interactions, for example, Travis Walton will describe grays, he'll describe blonde-type people in the craft. We start to move again. We start to figure out what's going on, and it's that consciousness thing that aliens, from all the descriptions, whether it's a contactee, an experiencer, an abductee, they all talk about this telepathy thing, this mind thing. And that's where we have to go in order to learn anything new. We have to get to talking to aliens. And a lot of people don't want to because we're so ostracized already. Our friends laugh at us. Everybody thinks we're crazy. And if we start talking about talking to aliens, then really nobody's going to talk to us. And that's why we want the government to do the study. That's why we want the media. We want science, because none of us wants to stand up and say it's extraterrestrial. And the only way you're going to get the evidence that it's extraterrestrial is to get inside the craft. And people will say, for example, there's a lot of noise in terms of consciousness, that there's too much noise compared to the signal. But it's the same thing with ufology. That's a problem you have to solve. And if you talk to Travis Walton or people who have been abducted, they will tell you that there is no noise, that the telepathy is clear, that they've got this down pat. And even if you look at Chase Brandon, when Chase Brandon was talking, he used the word phenomenology. And that is a word, as far as I'm concerned, that is a word that's used in intelligence. We use the word at the CIA. They don't refer to it as UFOs. It's referred to as phenomenology. It's all together, whether it's ghosts, remote viewing, ESP, UFOs. It's all this phenomena that there is an underlying something that we don't understand. Like 1,000 years ago, we didn't understand electricity. There's something there that we don't understand. Once we understand that underlying principle, will explain to us exactly what is going on. And that's where I say is consciousness is the most important thing we should be studying, this idea that we have to interact with this phenomena in order to advance. Otherwise, we're just going to be doing the same thing over and over, having red ones, green ones, fast ones, big ones, small ones, and coming to no definite conclusion.
You know, Grant, you're a very objective fellow, and are you connected with any groups? As far as I know, you're pretty independent. You may be a member of MUFON. I've never asked you.
The odd time I'll join MUFON for a year, and I interact with the different people. I'm not really a sort of a group type person where it's, you know, how are we going to research? How are we going to do that? I just basically look at, for example, Ronald Pandolfi is a person of interest. That's what I want to. I want to get in around this guy, hear what he says. I'm more interested in finding who's got the answer, because I think it's like the one thing I'm going to talk about in my lecture is the fact that there was a study that most people don't know about that was done by Bob Wood. I don't know if you're familiar with the study.
No, I'm not, but I'm familiar with Dr. Wood, of course.
Yeah, Dr. Wood. And this was, I said no intelligence agency ever contacted me, but I was contacted once by a guy who claimed to have these documents. I thought, finally, someone's going to give me some documents. This is fantastic. And what it turned out to be was when Bob Wood was an engineer at Douglas Aircraft, he went to Douglas Aircraft and he said, and this was in the same period of Blue Book when the Condon Report was going on from 1960 to 1968 to 1970, he said to the head of Edwards, to Douglas Aircraft, he said, there's technology here. We should be working on this as engineers. And they were given the okay to research UFOs. And so they spent $500,000 on researching UFOs. They spent more than the Condon Committee did it from 68 to 70. So they produced a study, and part of the study that they did was they had somebody who was actually, they were talking to people who have been abducted. Because Bob Wood's impression was, and this is the way I follow it, is if this is a phenomena, it's going to be common sense that if you do enough work and you put one foot in front of the other, if the aliens figured out how to do this, we can figure out how to do it too, that you believe it's there. And so what they were doing as part of this study is they were talking to abductees, and they were trying to get from the abductees, had you talked to the aliens? How does this thing work? And they had realized that the part of the thing had to do with this talking to the aliens, that you couldn't just look at sightings and stuff. And they spent a lot of time and a lot of money dealing with people who were, abducted. And I believe the same thing happens. You have all these MILAB cases, these military abductees, where the story is that the military will re-abduct an abductee. And that makes sense, that you can't go and ask them questions. I'm from the CIA. I want to ask you questions about your abduction. What you do is you use drugs, and you get them back into that state where you open up the consciousness, you open up that block, and you ask them, what did the aliens say? Where are they from? And you try to get the technology out of this abductee. So that's the whole concept. And what mm-hmm. had happened when this guy was going to leak the documents, I figured it was, it was going to be government documents, and it turned out it was the Douglas documents, and Bob Wood was very upset when he first heard that I had these documents. And what had happened was the guy who was doing the abduction research for them had a set of documents, and Bob had a set of documents, and all the engineers had a set of documents, and they were all like classified in, they had to be kept in vaults and stuff like this. And this guy died. He had a farm. He had died, and he'd left the documents in the barn, and the guy that found bought the barn saw these documents and sold them on eBay for $20. So the guy that bought them on eBay comes to me with these secret documents. I figure they're government documents. And then I find out, they're not government documents, and I really wasn't that interested. But it is, I put them on a site called Check the Evidence. It's a site in the UK. And you can see these documents. There's 275 pages of documents. This is Bob Wood. This is engineers from Douglas Aircraft. And he actually talked about the fact that when McDonnell Douglas, when it came together, he went to the head of James McDonald and related this thing about consciousness and talking to abductees and stuff, and that the president of Douglas Aircraft or McDonald Aircraft was so interested that he gave him $20,000 funding to look into this aspect. And basically, that's where I look at ufology. It's simple. It's like engineering. There's an answer. Forget about all the people laughing. This is the way it seems to be going. This seems to be an answer that if you can find a way to talk to whoever's in the craft or talk to the people who've been in the craft, like Travis Walton, and if you do enough of that, you're going to start figuring out who these people are. I don't think right now we can learn anything more from what we have, because by watching things fly around in the sky, you can't tell where they're from, you can't tell what they're doing here, and you can't tell who's inside those craft. You've got to get in the craft or you've got to talk to them. It's as simple as that. So that's the whole consciousness thing. And then I even, some of the stuff that fit, but let me give you just a bizarre example. When one of the main things that my Bible is a book written by Dr. Michael Newton. And it's a book about life between lives. And I won't get into that whole thing. And he's got 7,000 cases of people he regressed, and he goes through this whole thing. And he talks to them about what it's like to be between one life and the other. And one of the things that they describe is they describe screen imaging. They describe how people come to meet them and they appear to be a certain person, but it's not that person. It's the sort of the spirit putting on this image. The aliens do exactly the same thing. The other thing that's bizarre, I mean, that they describe, Bruce talked about this documentary in 1988, UFO Cover Up Live. If you remember back and you go to play it, and it's on the internet, it's on YouTube, UFO Cover Up Live, you can play this. And when the Falcon is talking, he talks about the book, the yellow book that was written by the aliens. And he said the book was given to them and it had the whole history of the aliens. And then he talks about the crystal. And he said the most amazing thing that the Falcon had seen was a crystal. And this apparently, according to Bill Moore thought that Jamie Chandray actually saw this crystal. And it was a crystal that you could hold and it would be sort of dark. And you'd look at the crystal and you could actually see history. You could see things happening in history, like everything was recorded in this crystal. And Linda Howe tells a story about them being able to show the crucifixion of Jesus Christ in this crystal. So here's this idea of the crystal. If you go to Dr. Michael Newton's work, it's called Journey of Souls, you will see them describe in the between lives the crystal. It was like when I saw that, I went, wow, just exactly the same thing, which verifies what abductees are claiming, that there's certain elements that they're showing about screen imaging and all this kind of stuff, that if you look in spiritual literature, you will find exactly the same phenomena. It proves that it's a phenomena, and if we do enough work and figure it out and put one foot in front of the other, as Bill Clinton says, you walk enough steps, good things will start happening. So that's what I've said, that we've got to start getting into the consciousness thing. We've got to get away from just straight sightings, because with Bruce McAfee, you can do all these things. There's a question I would ask Bruce is, what is the best photograph you have, and does it prove what the phenomena is? And I would say the answer is no. It just, the most you can get is, it's a very bizarre phenomena. It's undetermined. It's we don't know what it is. It's not this, it's not that, but it doesn't tell us what the phenomena is. You've got to get inside the craft or talk to the aliens.
Now you're going to make this entire presentation this weekend in Philadelphia. You know what time you're going to be on?
I'm on first thing Sunday morning, and then we are on for disclosure panel in the afternoon. I'm on with the disclosure guy himself, Steve Bassett, and Richard Dolan. So that should be interesting. We're having a panel on disclosure.
Maybe we can get some people there to see. I mean, you've really done some yeoman work on all of this, and I'm impressed with your consciousness efforts as well. One final question. We're really late, but I got to ask you. People in the chat room, they wanted to. A guy came up with an idea that I think might work. He's talking about if you had an encounter with an ET, could you use a frequency device of some sort? In other words, has anybody ever tried that? I wonder. I guess you just don't know when you're going to have an encounter is a problem.
Well, you see, that's one of the things that proves that consciousness is part of it, is one of the, when the abductee research is going on, you probably already know that they've tried numerous times to put cameras into the bedrooms of abductees to film the abduction, and it never works, because if the abductee knows that the camera is there, when the aliens come, they know the camera's there because they can read the person's mind that there's a camera there. So what you'll get when they put the camera in the abductee's room is you'll get the abductee getting up and turning the camera off, and then the abduction recurs, and then the abductee comes back and turns the camera back on after the abduction is over. If it's in the person's mind, the aliens are picking it up. So that's always the problem with trying to outdo the aliens. We can never outdo the aliens because they can read what we're doing. They know what's in our mind, and unless you can shield that, nothing's going to work.
With that, we'll leave it. Grant Cameron, thanks for coming on, and we'll talk to you when you get back from Philadelphia.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
So thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back on Monday night with our regular UFO show. And I'd like to thank Jane Swartley of our staff, producer and web producer for JerryPippin.com, for her efforts as well. And feel free to check out our website sometime, won't you? JerryPippin, is in Paul, all one word, JerryPippin.com. Thanks for listening. Until then, cheers.